So imagine you're sitting at a beautiful beachside cafe in Spain.
Sounds nice.
Right? The sun is shining, your glass is full of ice water, and you're just looking out at the Mediterranean. And you probably think you understand exactly where you are.
Oh, for sure.
You see the menus in like five languages, the white tables, the tourists. It feels like the place has introduced itself to you, and it all makes perfect sense. But today, on this deep dive, we're going to look at a field story that shows how everything you think you see from that table might actually be, well, a total illusion. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's great to be here. And we're doing something a bit unique today, serving as a spoken notebook companion to a very specific kind of text. Before we dig into the mechanics of this coastal town, we really need to set the boundaries of what this source actually is. We are looking at a composite field story set in a place called La Carihuela.
Let's clarify what quote unquote composite field story means for the listener, because I mean, this isn't a traditional news investigation, is it?
No, it absolutely is not. The author is very explicit about the limits on this text. It is not an investigation, and it's not a piece of, verified hard news reporting.
Right.
The location is real, and the social tensions are real, but some of the details and timelines have been deliberately compressed.
And that compression serves a purpose.
Exactly. It protects the privacy of the people involved, but it also isolates the underlying systemic elements so we can actually read them clearly.
Okay, so our mission today isn't to debate international geopolitics or like parse out the legalities of migration policy.
Right, definitely not.
We're exploring the central tension of this field story, which is how we actually read a physical place. We're going to dive into the illusion of shared spaces and the hidden systems that completely divide people who are sitting at the exact same table, looking at the exact same view. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
So the story begins with a very specific, almost counterintuitive action by a local. The narrator's mother lives in this coastal town. She's lived there long enough that the beach is, quote, no longer a postcard. But when visitors arrive, she doesn't take them on a grand walking tour of the promenade.
No, instead, she starts by showing them where to sit.
Yeah.
She begins the entire introduction to the town with a chair.
Which feels totally bizarre to a tourist, right?
Oh.
The visitors sit down at a bar table. The mother orders a glass, a coffee, a cola, some water with ice. And the visitors just look out at the water, assuming the sea is the main character of the town.
Naturally.
But the author drops this incredible observation right here. They say the coast does not introduce itself. It repeats until someone learns how to read it.
Yeah, that concept of repetition and reading is, I mean, it's the foundation of the whole piece. The text points out a fundamental disconnect happening right there at the cafe table. The visitors can see the sea perfectly well,
Right.
but they cannot see the system that fills the water glass sitting right in front of them.
It makes me think of going to see a massive theater production. Like, as a tourist, you buy a ticket, you sit in the plush seats, and you just look at the stage. You see the actors, the lighting, the beautifully painted backdrop, which in this case, that's the sea, the multilingual menus, the sunny promenade.
That's a great way to look at it, the performance.
Exactly. But the mother in this story, she isn't watching the play. She is looking at the backstage crew. She sees the rigging, the pulleys, the stage manager calling cues in the dark. She sees the hidden systems that are actually making the performance possible.
That theater analogy perfectly captures the quote, first mistake identified in the text, which is the assumption that proximity is access.
Yeah.
People assume that just because they're sitting physically close to the water, they somehow comprehend the landscape. But the text explicitly notes that just because the mother lives close enough to the sea, that doesn't mean she always goes into the water.
Right, because physical closeness to a location doesn't equal systemic understanding of how that location operates. So I want to push on that idea of systems, because the text immediately pivots from the invisible system that fills a water glass to an economic system that is incredibly visible, like literally operating right on the promenade, yet it remains completely misunderstood by the people visiting. The text calls it the nervous market.
Yeah, shops without walls. It is such a striking visual.
It really is. You have these huge sheets laid out directly on the pavement, and they're covered in bags, sunglasses, bracelets, football jerseys. It's a full retail storefront, just like laid out flat on the ground. But the defining characteristic, and the reason it's called a nervous market, is how it behaves.
What's fascinating here is the mechanics of that nervousness. The author describes the market as operating with one eye on the potential customer and one eye on the corner.
Always watch it.
Right. When a threat approaches, like the authorities, the market physically alters the shape of the coast.
It reminds me of a school of fish. You know, if you've ever gone snorkeling, you see this massive, cohesive shape made of thousands of fish. But the second a predator darts in, the entire shape shatters, vanishes into the reef, and then seamlessly reforms the moment the predator leaves.
That is exactly what happens.
That's what these sheets do. The corners are pulled, the goods vanish, the men move. And the text sharply notes that the promenade might become cleaner in that moment, but not necessarily more honest.
And out of that shifting, evading market, the story forces us to look at one specific individual, the man walking around carrying watches, the one who approaches the cafe table saying, "Real Rolex, my friend."
Okay, I have to admit, when I read this part, my first instinct was pure skepticism. We all know this guy.
Oh, absolutely.
If you sit at any tourist trap in the world, someone is trying to sell you something while you eat. The text even points out that tourists immediately learn his movement and refuse it before he even arrives at the table. They just wave him away. So how can a field story possibly frame a nuisance hawking fake Rolexes as, like, an essential piece of infrastructure?
Well, that reaction is exactly what the author is playing with. The visitors wave him away. Even the local expats wave him away. The text notes that these expats might be local in their complaints, but they are not local in their attention.
Right.
But the mother doesn't wave him away because to her, he isn't an interruption. She actually knows his name.
But, I mean, knowing his name doesn't make him a structural pillar of the economy.
It does when you look at the hidden mechanics of what he actually provides. The text asks us to consider what happens when something breaks. A watch strap snaps or a battery dies. The author describes a broken watch beautifully, calling it a piece of small metal patience that has finally stopped agreeing with the world. Yeah. And when that happens, this man doesn't just try to sell a new one. He takes the broken watch in his hands and he opens it.
And he actually fixes it. Right there.
Without making a show of it, his hands know exactly what to do because he's done it 1,000 times. The visitor who just blindly waved him away a moment ago sits there and watches him perform this highly technical labor. But the mother already knew he could do it.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The text points out the deep irony of this moment. He is fixing a watch, which is literally a machine designed for agreeing with the rest of the world about what time it is right next to a sea where the people occupying the space do not share the same time at all.
Yeah, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the temporal reality of the coast is totally fractured. The holidaymaker has one time, which is leisure time. The local worker has another time, dictated by shifts and seasons. The retiree has another. They share the physical space, but their rhythms are entirely disconnected.
Okay, so he repairs the watch, but that still just sounds like a one-off transaction, you know? How does he transition from a handyman to what the text calls market architecture?
Because his utility goes far beyond the watches. He is essentially a navigator of small, hidden routes. These aren't the official routes you pull up on your phone's map. He navigates the invisible routes between a need and an object. The text explains that if the mother needs something specific, like a winter jacket, and doesn't know where to get it, he can procure it.
So he has no shop front, no corporate backing, no receipt machine.
But he has recognition. And crucially, the mother has his phone number. The text clarifies this beautifully. She doesn't have his number in a sentimental way. She keeps it for purely practical reasons. She has it so that if the watch she just fixed breaks again, she can call him and complain.
That is such a human detail. She wants to be able to complain about the service.
Right.
But it completely shatters the tourist's perception of him. The tourist sees a ghost passing through the tables. The mother sees a reliable vendor with a phone number and a return policy based entirely on trust and mutual recognition. That invisible bond is how the market survives when the authorities turn the corner.
Now, we've explored the hidden economic infrastructure. But the field story uses that as a stepping stone to explore the hidden social infrastructure, which operates under the exact same principles of invisibility. The text introduces the concept of how different maps overlap in a single physical space by looking at a local bingo game.
Yeah, and when I think of bingo, I think of a permanent community hall, fluorescent lights, maybe a church basement. But that is not how it works on this coast. The text describes this bingo game as a moving room.
It physically shifts from bar to bar.
How does a whole room just move without the tourist noticing?
It moves based on a localized internal logic that outsiders can't track. It depends on which bar is open, who recently changed owners, and which owner still knows the local players. The physical signs on the street change, the chairs they sit in change, but the players themselves know the invisible route.
So a single bar effectively has multiple conflicting identities. In the morning, a tourist walks in and gets a coffee. It's a standard business. In the afternoon, it's a watering hole. But by the evening, to the locals, it transforms into what the text calls a small aging infrastructure. They essentially hijack the tourist space and turn it back into a local living room.
They do, until a specific word enters the space and shatters it. The text points out that from inside the room, among the locals, playing bingo didn't feel like gambling. It was simply older people knowing where to go to be together. It was a social anchor. But then the word license gets introduced.
Why did that word destroy it?
Because a license is an external, formal categorization. It forces an organic, invisible social gathering to justify itself to an outside legal system. Once the concept of a gaming license is imposed, the room is no longer a community gathering. It becomes an illegal gambling operation. External rules impose themselves and fracture the local space.
So what does this all mean for the visitors sitting at the cafe with the mother? They are slowly realizing that when she chose that specific chair, at that specific table, she wasn't handing them a tourist itinerary. She was giving them a map of attention.
A map of attention is the perfect way to phrase it. It's not about street names or historical landmarks. It's about knowing which bar still functions as a room for the locals. She knows who sits where, she knows who is waiting for someone, and she notices who has stopped coming.
The text even mentions the other people sharing this hidden room, like the English partner who sometimes sits at the table carrying a dry, polite version of London with him, or the bartender who quietly observes and sees far more than he ever says out loud.
And this brings us to the second mistake the author identifies. If the first mistake is thinking proximity equals access, the second mistake is assuming that looking at the same view means you exist in the same system.
Wow, yeah. You can have four people at a table all looking at the exact same Mediterranean Sea, but they are living in completely different realities.
They share the physical table, the tourist, the mother, the watchman, the bartender. They can all see the quick shops folding up on the sheets. On a clear day, they can all see the other side of the sea where continents meet. But the route they take through that space is fundamentally different.
And to prove just how disconnected these shared spaces can be, the text brings in a massive external political force.
Yeah.
Brexit. But it does it so subtly.
This is a vital mechanic to understand. The text observes that when Brexit happened, the physical table did not move. The sea did not budge an inch. The climate was exactly the same, but the passport changed.
The legal relationship to the ground beneath their feet fundamentally fractured.
Exactly. For some of the people sitting at that shared table, what had previously felt like a casual lifestyle suddenly materialized into heavy bureaucratic paperwork. The temporal reality shifted again. One day, you are a local resident enjoying a coffee. The next day, an invisible border drops right onto the cafe table, and you are a foreign national navigating a hostile bureaucracy.
It is a chilling reminder of how fragile a shared physical space really is. So, having built up this incredibly intricate map of attention, the feel story moves toward its climax. The visitors sitting with the mother have been there long enough that their perception is shifting. They are starting to see the watchman differently.
But the text is very careful to maintain its realism here. It explicitly states, people do not become better that fast. The visitors don't suddenly view the watchman as some noble hero or a completed moral lesson.
Which I appreciate, because a neat Hollywood ending would feel incredibly fake here. What they actually experience isn't enlightenment, it's hesitation. Before, they would have sorted him into a neat, dismissive little box. You know, just another hawker. But now they've seen the quick market fold up. They've watched his hands expertly open a broken watch. They've heard the mother use his actual name. He is no longer a generic interruption.
And that is exactly when the disruption happens. The rhythm breaks. Earlier, the watchman had mentioned he was going home to visit family. He said he would be back, and then he wasn't. The time he was expected to return comes and goes.
And the locals notice. The mother looks for him. If those visitors were still on their first day, they would have just seen a man passing between tables and thought he was a minor disturbance. They couldn't possibly know what it meant when that specific disturbance failed to show up.
This is where the field story entirely separates itself from traditional reporting. It emphasizes that the people at the table are worried, but the source of their worry is highly localized. They aren't worried because they read a new migration report in the paper. They aren't concerned because of a debate in Europe.
They are worried because the rhythm of their daily life had changed, and a person was missing from it. The story doesn't start with geopolitics or the far shore. It starts with a broken watch that could be fixed, a phone number that worked, and a man who was expected back but never arrived.
This raises an important question about the mother's role. The text describes her as a foreign local. It clarifies that this title has nothing to do with her legal citizenship or where her passport was issued.
It's entirely about her capacity for attention. She possesses the local map. She understands the rhythm. And I think that leads to the most profound insight the author is driving at the true definition of what makes a physical place alive.
Because a lot of people measure a place by its vitality. Are the views beautiful? Are the tables full of customers? Are the cash registers ringing?
But the text rejects that entirely. It argues that full tables and busy streets are just signs of trade. They are economic indicators. A place only truly becomes alive when ordinary people become visible inside its rhythm.
That is the ultimate test. It's not about the constant arrival of strangers on vacation. The true test of a place is whether someone expected can fail to return, and someone sitting at a cafe table actually realizes that something is missing.
Which brings us to the most poignant part of this deep dive. The text explicitly leaves the narrative unresolved. We never find out what happened to the watchman. Did he get held up at a border crossing? Did he choose to stay with his family on the other side of the sea? Did something tragic happen? We don't know. And the mother doesn't know. The story does not offer a neat resolution, and it intentionally avoids offering a grand policy solution to fix the invisible borders dividing the people sitting at that bar.
It forces us to sit with that uncertainty. Because that uncertainty is the reality of the map of attention.
It really makes you want to map out the attention in your own life. For you listening right now, think about your own neighborhood. Think about your daily commute or your favorite coffee shop. Who are the people that you treat merely as movement between spaces? The person sweeping the street, the person delivering packages, the person fixing the curb. And who are the people you would actually miss if the rhythm of your day suddenly changed? Would you even notice if they didn't come back tomorrow? Because as this text warns us, watch out for water. It carries more routes than it shows.
A powerful final thought to leave on.
This audio was generated from the article alone. It is a companion layer, not an independent source or verification.